Welcome to this special episode of the Marvelous Synergy Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Tai, writer of several guides to the Marvel Cinematic Universe that are also called Marvelous Synergy. As some of you may know, I was a background extra on Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings. Well, I was lucky enough to also be a background extra on Thor: Love and Thunder. Never in my wildest dreams did I think I'd get to work on two MCU projects. In this special episode, you'll hear about my time on set, the experiences of several other background extras, as well as someone from Odd Studios, the Australian company behind some of the film's prosthetics and special effects makeup. The fourth Thor film was shot in Sydney, Australia, thanks to a $24.1 million location incentive grant from the Australian federal government and support from the New South Wales state government. Filming took place in the first half of 2021 under the working title The Big Salad. Sometime after Shang-Chi wrapped, I was contacted by Marvel and asked if I wanted to be a part of the fourth Thor film. Specifically, I was asked if I was claustrophobic, had any issues working long hours, and whether or not I'd be willing to shave my head. I had no problems with any of that, and so of course I said I would love to be a part of the film. I would go on to learn that I'd be playing an Indigarian, specifically an Indigarian soldier. Comic book readers will know that the planet Indigar is home to a race of bold, blue-skinned aliens. One of the Indigarian soldiers I became friends with was James Saladu. This was James's first time being a background extra, and he got onto Thor the way most extras do, via an agency.
So my dad used to be an extra when he was young in the Philippines. He used to talk about it, you know, here and there with my sister. We found it interesting. We never really did anything about it. But one day my sister got an ad saying that they were looking for extras to be part of a talent list for an agency. So me and my sister applied in curiosity. Unfortunately, there's a yearly fee, so this was more of a serious kind of list. I didn't want to pay the yearly fee nor my sister, so we declined the offer. But I was still intrigued to see if I can get into a film directly. So I started searching up on Facebook ads for using words like background extra or Sydney extra, and to see if there's anybody looking for people directly through like public posts. Fortunately, I found one. There was from another agency looking for people, short people, like 5 foot tall males for a Marvel film in Sydney. And perfectly, that ad was posted a week before I did my searches. So I gave them a text saying that I want to be part of this. And they gave me a text back asking for my headshot. So I gave them my photo of my headshot and my details. And then next minute, I was called in to be measured. And I think from there, it just started. And then I became part of the Thor: Love and Thunder film set. And it was crazy. Yeah, that's how it all started.
The entire Indigarian prosthetic and makeup process took about 1.5 hours to complete, which meant all the extras playing Indigarians had to get to set really early. The call time for my first day was 3 a.m. When we arrived, we were pretty much stripped down to our underwear, put on a robe, and get to hair and makeup. Here's PC Flores, who also played an Indigarian, recounting what the makeup process was like.
Hi, my name is Peachy and I was also an extra on Thor: Love and Thunder. I was an Indigarian and we were basically all in blue. So our skin color was blue and we didn't have any hair. So they initially when they answered the casting call, they asked me if I wanted to shave my head. And I thought about it long and hard and I declined respectfully. And about, I think, a month or two later, they came back and said, well, actually, we need some more Indigarians. And would you do it if you didn't have to shave your head and just wore a bald cap? And I said, heck yes. And so obviously the blue paint took a long time. So they would put it on us initially with sponges, and I think there was like 5 or 6 layers of paint. So the last layers we would go out to the outdoors and it felt like a spray tan. So they would spray us in, you know, other shades of blue paint, then other shades of purple and little maroon sort of spots. Like to me, they look like sunspots. And so it was so meticulous and intricate, and like the texture of our skin just looked beautiful. And one of the things that we also had to do was wear prosthetics. So I remember that we had to wear prosthetics on our eyebrows as well as over our ears. And I couldn't hear. They cut little slits in the ears because they put the prosthetics over the top of it. And if ever I wanted to hear anyone, I'd have to put my finger through the prosthetic, which is really interesting. It was so fun to be an Indigarian and be an alien in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Given the large amounts of time we were spending with the makeup and prosthetics team, I was relieved to find that the people who were doing all this were really friendly. One person I got on well with was Nathan Larson. In addition to being the owner of many, many cool pop culture t-shirts, Nathan is a workshop junior for Odd Studios, the company that designed the Indigarian prosthetics, as well as many others for their films such as Gore. Given we are both huge Marvel fans, I asked him what it was like to work on Thor: Love and Thunder. So Nathan, what was your role on the film?
So my role in the film, Love and Thunder, I was a workshop junior. So what that meant for me was a lot of things. When it all kicked off and first started in the studio and we were in the development and making process, I was largely in mold shop. So what that meant was we were taking all of the sculpts and designs that the sculptors would make and they'd sent through to us. We would have to either make various fiberglass molds on top of 3D prints or flat plate molds for makeup prosthetics and essentially create all the molds and pieces that we would use to run all of these appliances and costume items. Yeah, on top of all of that in the studio, we would really be doing a whole bunch of various bits and pieces, usually just a lot of the logistical stuff, you know, doing all the shopping runs, buying all the products and materials that we would need in bulk. Yeah, delivering things to and from set as needed. There'd be multiple trips a day where we'd need to run prosthetics as they were being made from the studio to Fox or to wherever location they were needed. So it'd be a pretty intensive process. Of course, in terms of makeup applications and things like that, with, of course, the Indigarians, we would all be there, all hands on deck, in the, you know, the car wash spray tents or anything else like that. But workshop juniors were sort of really on the lower tier of things, so it's sort of whatever needs doing, we jump in and try and get it done.
In addition to the work you did with the Indigarians, you were involved with the prosthetics for Gore. Take us through the process of what's involved in getting the appliances ready.
So what that involved was back in the workshop, we had a whole crew there who were running all the appliances. So after we had taken the sculpts for all the scarification designs that Adam Johansson and a lot of other people all sculpted and made, molds were taken of those in silicon. And once we got the colours figured out, they would be go through the process of filling those moulds and creating those appliances in various materials. Like for the arms, they were a silicon appliance that would then get adhered to Christian once all the colouring was done. And then there was another material known as Pro Bondo or Bondo appliances, which is made of this really sticky rubbery material that once you take it through the this very interesting process of creating this very sticky mixture that would be filled into a mold and scraped back so you retain all the detail but keep it really flat, that's stuck to a piece of acetate which is then put into a freezer for a few hours, and then straight out of the freezer that gets put into a dehydrating oven to dry it all out, and it holds its shape. Once we took those pieces for all the various scars and wounds and all these other detail components to Gore's look, we would get them all packed into sets, which were all in these pizza boxes. So every morning before the guys would start working on Christian's makeup, before we'd get there, we would all prepare these Bondo pieces. So we'd have to clean them all off with shellite, just to blend off all the edges and try and make those as best as we could, So that way when they're stuck down, you don't see any weird transitions. So it just smooths off onto the skin pretty seamlessly. So once we cleaned off all those edges, we would take the Bondo appliances with the acetate and we'd stick them down to transfer paper, tattoo transfer paper, which just like the temporary tattoos you get where you stick it down onto your skin, use a wet cloth from the back to transfer that to your skin. So we would stick the appliances onto this tattoo transfer paper and then we'd hold it up against a window or up to a light and we would trace the outside edge of the tattoo so that way when we cut it out of the tattoo paper and get it as close to the same shape as we could, the makeup artists like Adam, Emily and Carla, they could see the outline of exactly where these pieces were in relation to placing them onto Christian with the makeup map that they made to be able to replicate Gore's look each and every time. So we would trace out the outline on the reverse side of the tattoo paper on every single piece, and there were a very large number of pieces for Gore's look, all going across his cheeks, his eyes, going, of course, across the top of his head, going back down his neck. There are all kinds of wounds and scars and all that as well towards the later stages of the film where the fights were all taking place. We would have to do that to every single piece. Once they were on the tattoo paper, they were essentially ready to go. And the very last step is the Bondo pieces. As they're placed onto the tattoo transfer paper, they're stuck to an acetate, which is just the backing for the mould. So what we would have to do is the Bondo itself, of course, is really, really sticky. And if you tried peeling it away from anything, you would effectively ruin the piece. So to remove this backing from the acetate, you would have to use freeze spray, which is sort of a thing you can get for computers and things like that, for coolant. And we would need to use this freeze spray to essentially freeze the backing of the Bondo pieces and very carefully lift the acetate off the Bondo, as the freeze spray would allow the acetate to easily release from it. So that was a very delicate process, and sometimes we had some casualties where pieces didn't survive, but we had a lot of practice runs in the lead-up to Gore being on set. So once all the pieces were released with the freeze spray, and they were already stuck down to the tattoo paper that had been drawn on and traced on the back of it, we would all put them back into their corresponding sets. We would have five boxes. We would have one for the cheeks and brows. We would have the head pieces. We would have the back pieces. And we would also have feet pieces which weren't used at one point. We ended up making silicone socks of sorts of Christian's feet with all the makeup pre-applied. So he'd just pull those on. And then we had the wounds, which were all the like scars and cuts that would end up being on his skin towards the end. So once we'd have all these corresponding pieces in their pizza boxes, we would check in with the guys and see where they were at in terms of a certain stage of makeup. Once they had gotten a base colour down, before they'd start putting the various grey tones and things like that on top, when they were just about to start that colour application process, we would then drop the pizza boxes into the makeup room and set those aside ready for the guys so they could just go straight into applying those when they were ready. So that was sort of where my involvement in terms of the application process stopped. That really was where my involvement was in terms of Gore. We would be there in the morning to get everything ready to go. And likewise with Christian, we would also do the exact same process with his body double, the stunt double who would do some of the more dangerous stunts and things like that on set. So he'd effectively have to prepare two sets of his makeup for every given day that Gore was going to be on.
I understand that you also did some work on the Buskins, the bird-like creatures that attacked the Indigarians. What did that involve?
So the boot scans were definitely the biggest on-set involvement that I had on the film. The whole process was fascinating. The guys who would be doing all the designing, they did the sculpting on top of 3D prints. The 3D prints were a rough form just to block out the core shapes to make the sculptor's job of doing all the detailing a little bit faster, so they didn't have to fill up the bulk of the shape with clay. We would have the 3D prints all assembled, and then they would do all the fine detail work over the top of the 3D print. Once that was done, it was molded in fiberglass, and then we'd have to create a core, which would basically create the negative space so a human arm could fit inside of it. And then one of my main roles in the workshop was having to mass produce the core form that would slip inside the arm, so that the stunt actors who were playing the boo scans could fit their arms inside, and the shape of the arm wouldn't get distorted, because the skins for the boot scan arms were made of foam latex, which can retain incredible amounts of detail but still stays quite soft, so it can be posed and moved around like essentially like an animatronic with various armatures inside it. So one of the mechanists on the job, he created all these articulated fingers for a few of the arm sets, which had all these pulleys inside that the actors' fingers could move, and that in turn would move the actual fingers of the boot scans themselves. But in order for that whole structure to retain its shape, we would have to create an internal fiberglass shell, which all of that could be protected by. So that way the overall shape of the hand and the forearms wouldn't compress or lose its shape when it's being worn by the stunt actors. So we came up with a way of being able to fiberglass some armature wire for some static ones. These ones didn't move organically, but they could be posed and hold their shape. So for instance, when they're riding the hover bikes and things like that, we could just curl the fingers around the handlebars, and they would hold their shape to make them look like they were gripping onto elements and props and various bits and pieces. So we would fiberglass the armature wire to these shells. So the fingers would be attached to a plate which made up the hand, the back of the hand. And then that in turn, there was some bits of heavy-duty armature wire which connected the back of the hand to the forearm. And the forearm is where a large amount of padding would be placed, as that was the main bracing mechanism for where the whole arm would be able to lock in and be gripped snug by the stunt actor's arms. So that was all then inserted into the foam latex skins, and there was a lot of surgery involved in that. There'd be a lot of openings that would have to slice into the skin to be able to feed the fingers and everything through, and then a lot of people in our fabrication team, they were able to sew zippers and all that into the arms, so it could all be closed up and look seamless. And as an added bonus, those little zippers in the forearm, which was all hidden under wardrobe, at any point could be unzipped, and we'd have these air blowers connected to tubes that we could plug into their arms to allow cool air to be blown through into their arms for the suits, because the foam latex does, of course, insulate and trap in a lot of heat, so the stunties would all get very, very hot and sweaty in those outfits. So after they were all moulded and run and the internal core was all placed in, they were all painted up, and the core involvement with them after the development side of things in the workshop is I was part of the team on set who were assisting in dressing them. So we were working pretty closely with the wardrobe department. They did all the wardrobe designs and had their whole team to actually apply the costume elements on. But before they would get into the costume themselves, myself and a few other people, we would all have one stuntie to look after, and we would put the arms onto them, and both arms would be linked through zippers, which were done up at the front and the back, and that would basically hold the arms on. Once those were on, wardrobe would then come in and dress the rest of the denim vests and other costume items that would all get laced on around the arms themselves. And once they were all dressed and on set, we had a whole kit to look after all the stunties while they were in costume and on shooting, which was largely on the volume at Fox. And then at the end of the shooting days, same deal in reverse. We would get them all off set. We would take the headpieces off, have them all set aside, and we would rejuvenate those with various hair products and get them all ready for the next shooting day, clean them all out. We'd wait for the wardrobe teams to come and take all the wardrobe off. And once all that was removed, we would get them out of all the arms and the arm rigs for the boo scans themselves.
What are some of the more difficult or challenging aspects of your job?
Overall, I'd say a lot of this job has been quite a challenge. It's one that I've taken head on, as it's been an incredible learning opportunity. For something that I've always dabbled with, going back to, 2010 through 2012, when I was in my last years of high school. I did some amateur moulding and casting, and that's all I'd learned from reverse engineering videos and sourcing materials and products. This whole job has really given me the ability and opportunity to learn from industry professionals of how to do this whole mad science part of this industry a lot better. Largely some of the biggest challenges myself have been more to do with the makeup side of this industry, is I'd never really been exposed to the possibilities of what the makeup effects industry fully entailed. I'd always known of it and always had a great respect for it, but I didn't really know any of the processes or procedures involved. So with, like for instance, with as we did with you guys on the Indigarians, patting you all down with the powders to set all the colour in so you're not sticky and everything else. So I had no idea of any of that side of this industry. So it was an incredible learning experience jumping into that.
What advice do you have for anyone who wants to pursue this line of work?
If it's really something you're passionate about, just keep going, keep pushing, keep making things. As difficult as it gets and as disheartening as it can get, having those sorts of rejections of, various studios or companies saying, no, we don't have anything for you, just keep trying, because you just don't know. You might get something around the corner. There's always a chance. So that'd be my biggest bit of advice to anyone trying to break into any creative field, whether that's film, theatre, anything. Creatives, we wear our heart on our sleeves, and it's always hard trying to showcase and show our own work and show what we're capable of. And it can be scary doing that, but as long as you keep trying and don't let any rejection defeat you, it'll all work out in the end.
After being painted blue, we would get changed into our costumes. Mine consisted of a blue vest with a leaf-like pattern, light turquoise pants, a hat with flaps on the sides, and bright green sandals. What made me really excited about playing an Indigarian was not only going through an extensive prosthetic and makeup process, but also being on a stagecraft volume. For those that don't know, the volume is essentially a set surrounded by large LED screens. So instead of using green screens, which are later replaced with the digital background, the background is created first and then displayed on the screens during production. Using the technology provides filmmakers with a large number of advantages, including characters being lit with the correct coloured light, the ability to make adjustments to the digital background as needed, and parallax between the physical elements on set and the background. The technology was used on the Star Wars series The Mandalorian, which director Taika Waititi worked on. In the case of Love and Thunder, one of the scenes filmed on the volume was Thor meeting King Yakan. While I essentially played a corpse in the scene, you can spot me on one of the rocks, it was nonetheless thrilling to be on the set. It was incredibly immersive, and at times I really did forget I was on a film set. A group that played a bigger role in the film are the New Asgardians. Ari Tam, who was a Talo villager in Shang-Chi, returns to the MCU as a resident of New Asgard. One of the most memorable sequences he got to be a part of is the fight between the New Asgardians and Gore's shadow monsters.
Hey Andy, thanks for having me back. And it was great being back on another Marvel movie. So like you mentioned, the scene that I got to take part in was the nighttime raid on the village of New Asgard. I got to play one of the New Asgardians. Unfortunately, not one of the guardsmen in like the really cool looking uniforms, but I got to play one of the New Asgardians that gets woken up in the middle of the night and joins the battle in my pajamas. It was a bit of a change from Shang-Chi, where I had like these flowing red warrior robes, and then being reduced to having my Kmart brand flannel pajamas. Oh, and slippers. Can't forget the slippers. So, speaking of Shang-Chi, there were maybe a handful of extras from Talo that made it to the New Asgard set as well. And then collectively, I guess the backstory we all gave ourselves was, after the shenanigans, the demon attack in the village of Talo, we all decided to move away somewhere else for safety. And lo and behold, the new village that we decided to settle down in also gets attacked by more shadow demons. And so for this particular group of, Talo residents, they just can't catch a break. So some of the major differences in this experience compared to our time in Shang-Chi. Most of our time in Shang-Chi, it was all day shoots, whereas this time it was just a month of night shoots. So 5 days a week. I think we would get called to set around about 3 or 4 p.m. and then we wouldn't wrap until about that time in the morning the following day. Then you get enough time to go home and sleep and then come back and do it all over again. And once again, pretty similar to Shang-Chi, it was really just extras waving plastic weapons at imaginary monsters. The design of the shadow monsters, I don't think was locked down or finalized at this point of filming. So the descriptions that we got to work with basically, they just gave us like this very vague, it's a big monster with tentacles and arms and everything, and it takes about 6 of you to fight one because the visual effects artists don't want to have to animate an individual monster for every person. But all in all, it was a pretty great time. Similar to Shang-Chi, you know, we all got to make friends. Everyone gets to hang out and have fun during the downtime in between scenes. Chris and Natalie and Tessa are all super nice. Tessa was always keen to like say hi to the extras, and Chris and Nat too. It was really cool. It was a great little environment to sort of be in, I guess. Especially considering it was just so freezing cold and everyone was pretty sleep deprived towards the end of the shooting day. Yeah, speaking of the cold, you may notice in some of the edits, I guess, or if there are any longer scenes in the battles, as soon as the pyrotechnics special effects guys turn up the heat and we yell action, you'll see like a lot of extras. Suddenly, like they're fighting monsters that are a lot closer to the burning buildings and burning cars, because that was literally the only source of heat we got to hang around during the night. Otherwise, everyone was just jumping under blankets and everything as soon as we yelled cut. Another sort of thing that was a first for me, we got to actually be on set when there were some major explosions. Like, at one point, a big monster is meant to come barreling out of the boat shed and then, like, flips a car onto, like, another car, or flips a boat onto a car, and there's, like, a major explosion. And it was really good. Like, there was a really, really strong, very strict safety briefing beforehand, and we got to practice and rehearse multiple times before they finally, you know, say, this is the take that we're going to do with the pirate, the explosion and everything. And even though you rehearse it there, once something does explode, like once the special effects guys set off the charges, it's, you know, it doesn't take a lot of acting to react to that kind of stimulus. It was a really, really good night that night when we blew up a boat, basically. I don't even know if that made it onto the final cut of the movie, because that battle just happened so quickly. All in all, it was a really cool experience. Like I said, got to hang out with and meet a large group of extras, and we all sort of banded together against the cold, and everyone just had like this shared sort of really cool, fun experience. And yeah, it was just a lot of fun running around, essentially LARPing, I guess.
In addition to being a background extra, Ari also worked on the film as an on-set nurse.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, this time around, in addition to just being an extra, I got to work as crew behind the camera. I work as an on-set nurse. So every production has an on-set nurse or medic that is there on hand, obviously for any kind of emergencies. But we're also there for a non-emergency sort of medical aid, I guess, as well. So the scenes that I was kind of a part of as an on-set nurse, I was the additional on-set nurse. The primary on-set nurse would have looked after the crew, but for a feature film like this, there's obviously a large amount of crew everywhere. So when there are scenes that are involving a lot of extras, there's usually an additional nurse, or in Australia, for child labour laws, there's usually an additional nurse whenever there's scenes involving kids, because the primary nurse can't look after the crew as well as be the primary carer for the kids on set as well. So obviously in a film like Thor, there are a lot of kids that are involved in some of the stunts, and so they sort of brought me on board as an additional to look after the kids during those scenes. I spent quite a bit of time with the alien kids and the Asgardian kids that you see that have been captured and put into cages. Most of the scenes that I was part of as a nurse was mostly would have been the battle scenes where Thor imbues them with the power of Thor, or the lightning, and then they go and run and fight all these shadow monsters. There's, believe it or not, there are quite a few kids that are stunt kids. I think there are a few martial arts schools that specialize in teaching kids martial arts techniques that look good on film. So there is an agency for stunt for kids stunt work, I guess. So in terms of kid child safety, child labor laws, one of the main roles for a nurse is to enforce the strict number of hours that kids are allowed to work. So in Australia, depending on the age bracket that the child is in, they can only work a certain number of hours a day and a maximum number of days per week, depending on how old they are. So a 0 to 3-year-old might only be able to work one day a week, whereas teenagers up to 16, they're fine to work 5 days a week for a certain number of hours per day. The other main part of the role as well, also to do with like the welfare of kids, we just have to make sure that the kids are never put into a situation where they would ever be uncomfortable, and they're always, I guess, handled appropriately by mostly like hair and makeup, and like especially the wardrobe department as well. So there's always a chaperone with them when they're getting dressed and that sort of thing. And it's usually fine because the kids always turn up with their guardian, either a parent or one of their other legal guardians. So I was lucky that I got to work alongside the parents and guardians. And the crew, there are chaperone crew members as well. So they're crew that get hired specifically to chaperone kids around. Much like what an assistant director would do for adult extras. So making sure they go from the holding area to the right set safely, and just making sure everyone's getting a lunch break, that sort of thing. So yeah, so that's my main role as the on-set nurse for any kind of production, really. Thanks for your time.
One of my best friends was also fortunate enough to play a new Asgardian. Here's Keelan Judge to talk about becoming a part of the production and his time on set.
So Andy, you and I were helping each other find extras work at the time. We'd actually worked together on an Aussie production called Around the Block years ago, and I was helping you, and then this other casting call came along that you found out about, and it was asking for tall, lanky, long blonde-haired dudes, which was exactly what I was and still am. I was growing my hair at the time, and they were after a Viking look. You thought that's exactly what I could apply for, so I gave it a shot, and it sounded exciting. I wouldn't have got this gig if it weren't for you, so thank you for that. And then the application process was pretty brief. I didn't go to an audition, so I signed up for this new agency, and then I had to fill out some forms and then submit my pictures and then applied. And then I got told that I was accepted and then just had to turn up at certain dates. I had a costume fitting as well, where they did a check, and they did a check for hair and beard and just gave us some advice about how to maintain it basically before the shoot. We had to let it grow out a little bit, but that was it really. So my scene was in the new Asgard town hall after Gore's attack on the village. We weren't told any specific details at the time, which is often what happens as an extra. We get given very general details. So we were told that we were missing our children and that there had been an attack, but not by who or why or any of that. It was then left up to our imagination to be as distressed as possible, and they encouraged us to create backstories for this. This was part of the joy of being an extra, and led to some funny moments. Different extras had paired up with different people, and with my film wife for the day, she ended up competing with some of the others for who had the best husband, which became a bit of an in-joke. And it sounds really silly to say, but it's that sort of thing that you entertain yourself with between takes and during takes. So talking about the rest of my character's costume, I had this, you know, I'm there on screen. I've got a bit of time, but you don't quite to see the costume. It's there in sort of split seconds. I'm wearing this long purplish robe, and then there was also a grey shirt underneath. I can't really remember the pants I wore, but the robe, I just left an impression because it almost reached the floor and was always sort of sweeping. It sort of had these two sort of arms or two sort of tails that moved around a lot. Anyway, it gave me the sense that it was like a Viking monk. One thing that hit me when I was on set was how diverse the cast was, and that wasn't what I expected at all, because with my casting call, it was just, like I said, long, tall, blonde-haired people. I expected all the new Asgardians to be part of that. I hadn't seen Thor Ragnarok, all the other Thor films at the time. I ended up doing that because I was part of the production, and Thor Ragnarok I absolutely love, which we'll get to another time. But I didn't have context for who the new Asgardians were, and so I was expecting to just see a whole load of people, of long blonde-haired people, and that just wasn't the case at all. I actually stood out, which was a bit of a surprise. I was quite tall to most others there, so you can even see in the film, in the town hall scene, my head is above most people. I'm sort of just, my head's just sort of floating around at the top. it was to my advantage because in the part where Thor then decides to interrupt all the chaos and then present his inspirational speech to try and reclaim himself as Thor, this is part of the cheekiness of me trying to make sure I was getting in shot, but I decided to sort of track along the same camera motion at the back, and I could do that only because it was tall. So, like, you can see my head the whole time Chris is doing the speech, and I'm just walking along like I'm interested and like, I'm trying to gather with the rest of the crowd to see it, but secretly I just wanted to be in shot. Anyway, that was kind of fun. Anyway, that's a trick of the trade for you, any budding extras out there. I mean, where my height becomes a disadvantage as well is, at one point they had me standing right next to his stand-in. So for anyone who doesn't know this jargon, a stand-in is someone they get who is roughly the same height as the main actor and roughly looks like them, like same hair, same length kind of thing, same build, just to get an idea of how that actor is going to fill the space for when they're setting the shot. And that means they can do all their preparation beforehand, with the lighting, with the camera, with the other extras, getting all the motion right, the rehearsals. So when we did extras rehearsals, it was mainly with the stand-ins. All the main cast are usually in their own tent. I mean, they're around set, but they're not on the set. But then we're working with the stand-ins, and they had me there next to the stand-in at one point. And then when they were going to set the shot, when Chris was about to come in, I can't remember if he had yet or not, but they moved me away and went, "Sorry, you're too tall," and moved me away. And then they got these other extras, these really short elderly extras to stand next to him, which to me was hilarious. It was like they were making a really big effort to create this gigantic contrast between his size and his youth versus their compared to these shorter elderly ladies. One of the other things that made an impression of me was when Chris came on, I was just dumbstruck by how much taller he is. And I mean, he's reported as only being 6'3", and I'm like 6'1 and a bit, nearly 6'2". So it doesn't seem like that much difference. But I like also his width and his muscle size was like kind of intimidating. And all he did was just walk on. Like he's wearing this gigantic costume too, and the cape kind of sticks out as well. So I guess that was creating the impression that he might have been bigger. But I remember just being floored by the size of his arms and things like that. And I got like little jelly legs for a minute, and I was like, I'm getting ready to run. I'm joking, but yeah, it was a bit of a shock. Again, I had that sort of intake breath moment, I guess also because here he is, it's Chris Hemsworth. The way I've been describing his arms to the people who ask, knowing that I've been on now, I say it was like his biceps were like the size of my thighs. I'm a pretty skinny guy, so I can, you know, that kind of makes sense. My thighs are pretty small, but like, imagine having thighs for arms. That's kind of the situation we're talking here. Another cool part of the production, Natalie's talked about this publicly, is that they had to set up platforms to make her taller, which is partly because her character needs to be about 6 foot. And I reckon it's also because they want to get the eye line similar with Chris because he's so much taller. Anyway, we would do the rehearsals, like I said, without the main cast there. Or sometimes if they were doing lines, it would be with the cast, but then we would have to go away and they would be setting up. We wouldn't know what they were setting up for. We would then come back and there would be these platforms all set up. And this is when they were doing the, maybe the reaction shots or any dialogue or walking shots of Natalie with the rest of the scene, because they do, you know, different sides of the shot, right? And that's just something you have to do when you're doing film. Anyway, so they'd set up these platforms for her to walk along. And I mean, it was quite a surprise because it could stretch in such weird ways, but they connected so easily as well. You know, it was like putting jigsaw puzzles together. And so that was a cool thing to notice. And again, it was funny to think how that would work, but it's seamless when you watch it. It doesn't, I don't bat an eyelid. Life on set was actually pretty entertaining. I've been on other sets where it takes a lot longer and there's a lot of waiting time. There was still waiting time for this, but we kept alternating in and out. We would be on set for, you know, an hour, 2 hours sometimes, then come off and have half an hour to an hour break, maybe have something to eat. There was a little sitting area. Because this was shot in a studio in Sydney, it was all indoors for the scenes I was doing. And I was booked for 3 days. And out of those 3 days, I mean, they're pretty long hours. I don't remember them going for shorter than 8, maybe 6, but sometimes as long as 10 or close to 12 almost. I mean, by the time you come home and all that, it's like beyond 12. And there would be times where we would come to the sitting area and I would even fall asleep in the chair so we could get a little bit of rest. It could be really exhausting though. For those 3 days, I was getting maybe 3 or 4 hours sleep because I live in Wollongong. So I would drive up, which would take at least an hour, and I would have 5 a.m. calls. Maybe a little bit earlier, but it was about 5 a.m., which means I'm putting my alarm at about 3:30 at the latest so I can get ready. I like to eat before I go. And then I have to drive up for an hour, park, walk, get into the studio, and just sign in. And that's what it can be like as an extra. So you have to be ready for that if you're interested in being an extra. But it's really good fun. One thing I'm really happy about with the film is how much I made it into the final cut. When I was doing this, just with my limited past experience, I didn't expect a lot of this to get in. And also because I was sort of switching sides a bit, I didn't think that it would all make in. But almost something of everything that I did made it in. And I got way more screen time than I expected. Some of my friends even joked that I had more screen time than Matt Damon. Like, imagine being able to say that. I had more screen time than Matt Damon. He was there on set too. So that's one of the awesome things about there. One of my lasting memories is I was on a set that had Matt Damon, Natalie Portman, Chris Hemsworth, Taika Waititi, Tessa Thompson, Daryl. I'm sorry, I don't know the guy's name. I am trying to remember who else was there. But I think that was all the main cast. It would have just absolutely topped it if Christian Bale was there too. But I never saw him, never even saw what he would look like. I ended up being friends with one of his stand-ins though for the film. And so I'm friends with a guy who met Christian Bale and talked to him. They used to, because this often happens, the stand-in is nearby with them. They often hang out together. So I'm friends with a guy who knows Christian Bale, or like knows, you know, talked to him on set and was friendly with him. And said he was a really nice guy. So that's just an amazing thing about being on these productions.
And that's it for this special episode. I hope you all enjoyed learning about what it was like to work on Thor: Love and Thunder. I am incredibly grateful to have been given another opportunity to contribute to a franchise I absolutely love. Seeing Taika Waititi, Chris Hemsworth, Chris Pratt, and the other cast members work up close is something I will never forget. If you're interested in learning more about the MCU, you can find my Marvelous Synergy series of books on Amazon, Booktopia, and Barnes & Noble. Subscribe to this podcast to hear future episodes, and please like the Marvelous Synergy Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr pages to keep up to date with the latest MCU news. Thank you so much for listening.